This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Roshim, that all touch on the subject of Chesed, and I'm going to link them in, starting off with a question that I put last night onto one of those Midrashim. A very, very peculiar Midrash, a very disturbing Midrash. The Midrash says, Omar Rabbi Yitzchok, Limadat Chotoiro Derech Eretz. The Torah teaches us the way one should operate, the way one should live. And it's referring to a specific area. Shekeshe Yehei Odom Oise Mitzvah, Yehei Oise Oiso Belev Someach. When a person does a mitzvah, he should do it with a happy heart. And that's an interesting phrase in itself, to do it with a happy heart, not to do it as if it's some kind of weight or burden. She'ilu hayo Reuven yodea she'akudosh baruch hu machtiv alo vayishma Reuven vayatzileu miyodom. Because if you remember when the brothers were busy discussing what to do with Yosef, and the discussion took place and they decided that he was guilty of death and they were about to put him to death, and Reuven intervened. And Reuven said no ways and suggested that instead they throw him into the pit. What Reuven didn't know is that that action would be recorded in the Torah later on and would be learnt by every cheder child and by every adult throughout generations of generations and generations. It would be read in every shul on Shabbos. He didn't realize that it would be the subject of shiurim, of discussion groups, that millions and millions of people through the generations were going to read the story of Reuven. He didn't know that. Because had he known that, he would have carried Yosef back on his shoulders to his father. He wouldn't have left him lying in a pit. Very, very peculiar, because that seems to imply that Reuven compromised what he knew was right Reuven compromised what he... There's something interesting about the people who come late, and I'm not... And I understand it's Motze Shabbos, and it's difficult sometimes to get here, and I'm not being critical of any particular people. But there are things that are interesting about, and I think it's important that people learn and people understand. If you go to a movie, you very seldom see people coming in late. It's amazing. Starting time, people are there. Odd person comes in late. Very, very unusual. Usually if you're late for a movie, you don't even bother going. You've missed the first part. What's the point of going? The problem I have is that means that we value a shiur as less intelligent than a movie. For a movie, we think if you miss the first part, for Fallon, you're not going to understand anything. For a shiur, it doesn't really matter that much. If you miss the first part, you don't miss the first part. It's not the right approach to a shiur. So I know that it's Motze Shabbos. We try and start more than an hour after Shabbos is out. And there are always people, obviously, who just poshut can't make it, and I understand that, but I would ask you, please, there have been comments from a number of people that it's terribly disturbing for them. The shuffling and the moving backwards, it's not fair to the people who do come on time that they should be disturbed, so please be careful, and if you do come late, just sit in the back, quietly, and not to disturb other people. So Reuven compromises what he knew was right, means he knows that there's no new intellectual information that would have struck Reuven by knowing that this would be reported in the Torah. The only difference is he didn't know the public would know about it. That's all. So are we suggesting that a man of Reuven's stature would have acted differently in the public eye to the way he acted in private? Yes, we are. That's exactly what we're saying. That had Reuven known he was being watched, had Reuven known that his deeds were going to be reported and recorded and read and studied by thousands and millions of people, he would have done it very differently. He compromised his standard because he didn't know it was public knowledge. And a second example is with Boaz and Ruth. V'ilu haya yodea bo'ash HaKadosh Baruch Hu machtiv olo v'yatzbeit lo koli. Had he known that it would be written in the Tanakh and that every Shavuos we would read it for generations and generations to come, people would be learning this, he wouldn't have given her some grains of dried wheat to eat. When Ruth came to the field and she was hungry and she was looking for something to eat, that's not what he would have given her. He would have given her agolim petumim. He would have given her fattened calves, the best meat available, he would have fed her with. Had he known that this was going to be reported for all time in the Torah. And I asked last night, it just doesn't seem to make sense. Why would people of that stature not be giving of their best in any event? Why would people of that stature have two different standards? One standard for when they're in the public eye, and one standard for when they're not in the public eye. One understands ordinary people like us, sure, when we're in the public eye, we're going to behave a little bit better than when we're not. But people like Reuven and Boaz, surely they were operating to the maximum level of their ability in any event, and it would make absolutely no difference if people were watching or they weren't watching. It would make absolutely no difference if it was recorded in the Torah or it wasn't recorded in the Torah. But it's not so. The Midrash says it did make a difference to them. And therefore, whenever you do a mitzvah, do it belev sameach, do it with a full heart, implying also that the inadequacy in their actions was not just a quantitative one. That instead of dropping him in the pit, he should have taken him to his father. That instead of giving her dried corn to eat, he should have given her meat. That's not the issue. What seems to have been missing was an element of simchas halev, an element of absolute joy, an element of total involvement, or in the terminology of last week's shir, that energy that we're talking about, that spiritual limitless energy that one needs to invest into an action. And last night I answered it in a particular way, which I'll summarize now. And this evening I'm going to approach it from a different point of view. Last night I said part of the problem is that we don't fully understand and appreciate the value of our actions. And I explained that there were times when people suffered from arrogance. Today people don't suffer from arrogance. Today people suffer from the opposite of arrogance. Sometimes we think we're arrogant, but it's not arrogance. It's just it's bloated ego, which is not the same as arrogance even. Arrogance is when a person thinks that he's really very valuable. What we suffer from today is that most people think that they're not valuable at all. Or most people fail to appreciate the full degree of how valuable they are, and how valuable their actions are, and how God rates their actions. And here you're looking, and I explained last night, that these people were conducting normal lives. They didn't see themselves as playing a part as one of the characters of the Torah. They didn't go through their lives thinking of themselves as people who are going to be written up about, as playing out history. They didn't think. They were just acting in their normal kind of lives, like you and I. The argument with the brothers was a family issue that had to be sorted out. Boaz was doing his business in a normal sort of way. Ruth, a poor girl, comes along, needs some charity. He responds in a particular way. They didn't relate to it as anything particularly dramatic. It was just an ordinary event in an ordinary day of what they considered to be ordinary lives. In retrospect, we have a look at it and we say, but it wasn't ordinary lives. These weren't ordinary people. They weren't living ordinary lives. And their actions weren't ordinary actions. And the Midrash goes on to say that in days gone by, things used to get written up in the Torah if they were outstanding. What happens nowadays? Mi kosvo. And the Midrash answers, Eliyahu melech ha-Mashiach, v'akadosh baruch hu chosem al yadehim. Now too, things are being written, things are being recorded. Don't think history is closed. Just because the Torah, the Chumash was closed, Tanakh was closed, the Mishnah, the Gemara, all of that was closed. But the chronicling of history, the development of history, that's not closed. We're still playing a part. We're playing no less a dramatic part in the evolution of history towards the Messianic era than they were playing towards the Tanakhic era. They were playing a part. They were formulating the history of the Jewish people in the present. And so are we. And our actions are also recorded and will also become part of the future. We're laying the foundations of the future, and there will be a time when the future will study history. And we will be the subjects of that history. Whether we're mentioned by name or we're not mentioned by name, but then the point is that our actions are building up the future. Our actions are setting the tone. Each person in his own way is putting another brick into the foundations of what will be the messianic future of the Jewish people. And that future that will be built, we have a part in. And if there's some faulty bricks over there that belong to us, we put them there. And if there's some wonderful bricks there that hold up a large structure, we put them there. So we shouldn't underestimate the relevance, the value, the importance of our actions to God. And if we would really understand how valuable our actions are, we would act very differently. We would act with a lev sameach. If we thought it really made a big difference to the scheme of things, how we treated one another, and how we did the whether it's the right hand side or the left hand side, as we discussed last night, whether it's in our relationship to God or it's our relationship to people, if we really believed that it was important and significant, we would do it in a very different kind of a way. And we'll understand that a little bit better further on. But I want to approach the question differently. Back to the question of why is it, what was it in Reuven and in Boaz that inhibited them from superb performance? Is it possible that it was the absence of an audience that inhibited them from superb performance? What did we say last week? We said last week that the right hand side of the Luchos, that they know them lemakim, links into a limitless, infinite source of energy. We accept the Ribbono Shel Olam as the creator of the world. As the creator of the world, it's not just a one-off event that took place a long time ago. It's a constant nourishing of the world from a limitless source of energy, and we have access to that energy. On the left-hand side, we deal with the limitations of human possession. But what we've got is limited. Our property is limited, our material things are limited, our lives are limited, time is limited. The left-hand side deals with limitations and the need to respect those limitations. And we discussed last week that where is Chesed in the Ten Commandments? And we said that Chesed can't exist on the right-hand side and it can't exist on the left-hand side. Chesed only exists when the two are merged. When one takes from that infinite source of energy and one applies that to the limited resources of individuals, then one is involved in the act of Chesed. Which means we've got to redefine Chesed. Chesed is not merely transferring material things from one person to another. That's not Chesed. That might be charity, that might be tzedakah. Person's missing something and you give him what he's missing, that's charity, that's tzedakah, maybe. Chesed is much more than that. Chesed, there is a dimension to Chesed which is totally non-material. The dimension of Chesed is to tap into the limitlessness of what we have access to and to apply it to the limited. Now, the relationship between Ruth and Boaz in the book of Ruth is an important source for understanding some of the principles of Chesed. And it's interestingly that there's one of the Medrashim on our Sedra refers back to that. The Tanakh tells us in the story of Ruth, "Vayomer lo Boaz le'es ha'ochel," and Boaz said to Ruth, here's the strange non-Jewish girl in the field, and she's collecting charity for her Jewish mother-in-law. And he says that at eating time, Geshi Haloim, come closer, the Tovalt Pitech Bachoimetz, come and eat from the food that we've got, and you can dip your bread into the dippings here, into the vinegar, into the various different flavors that we've got. Vateshev Mitzad HaKoitzrim, and she stood and she sat down alongside the harvesters. Vayitzbot Lo Koli, and he stretched out to her and gave her some of these dried wheat things, the kind of popcorn sort of thing, I don't know exactly what it is, a dried wheat that they used to eat. And then it says, Vatoichal, Vatispa, Vatoiso. And she ate, and she left, and she was satisfied, and there was left over, she left some over. She didn't even finish her plate. Says the Medrash, on this week's Sedra, Amar Rabbi Yitzchok, Anan Sham Inan Mino Tarti. We can learn from this two things. Oy barocho shoyre b'yodo shelo yisot tzadik. Oy barocho shoyre b'me'eho shelo yisot tzadikis. Somewhere there's brocha here. We'll define that brocha in a moment. Either it's in the fingers of Boaz or in the tummy of Ruth. Where does it get it from? Because vayitzbat lo koli really means that he gave her a pinch of koli. Whatever this koli is, he gave her a pinch of it. So how much could it be? A few grains. And it says, and she ate, and she was satisfied, and she still left over. So somehow, a very small quantity of food achieved an enormous amount of internal satisfaction. So it's miraculous, it's not normal. Either we've got to say that it was the fingers of Boaz that did it, or that it was the stomach of Ruth that did it. And we'll analyze what that means in a moment. He goes on to say, Elo min ma dichtiv. However, if you analyze the words, Vatoichar, Vatispa, Vatoiso, Anu yodim shebrocha shoyre b'soich me'eho sholoiso tzadekis. From the words you can see that the brocha was in her tummy, but it wasn't his fingers. From the context, it could have been his fingers, but from the word, it was from the wording, the grammar, you can see it's her. Because she's active in it. It doesn't say, and she ate and she left over and she was satisfied and there was some left over. In the passive form, it says vatoisor, she left some over, meaning that it was from her side that she didn't need to eat as much. She, her needs were very, very small. She was able to eat a small amount and to feel completely satisfied. That's what the Medrash says. What do we see here once again? That a very small amount of material was used to achieve a great deal of satisfaction, and of material satisfaction. She was hungry. It wasn't a spiritual stuff. She was physically hungry. He gives her a very small pinch of food and she feels totally satisfied by it. Says the Medrash, it could be one of two things. Either it's in his fingers. What does it mean in his fingers? One needs to realize who Boaz was. Boaz was, at that time, the greatest Talmid Chochem. He was the greatest rabbinic authority of his generation. And he was also one of the greatest businessmen of his generation. So he was a multimillionaire. And he was one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim. Now, difficult to explain what that really means, but let's try and get some kind of idea. You remember at the time that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was ill and then he died. What kind of impact that had on his community worldwide? You know, Lubavitcher Rebbe, what he was to his community, he was a king. Now imagine a personality that was that, not to a segment of the Jewish community, but to the entire Jewish community. We don't have such people today. We have people who are leaders of various parts of the Jewish community, but we're not united enough. We don't have a Chofetz Chaim today. We don't have a Vilna Gaon. We don't have a Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. These were great lights only a few decades ago who did command the respect of the entire universe of Jewish life. And that's how Boaz was. Boaz was an authority, a rabbinic authority that was held in the highest of esteem throughout the Jewish world. On the other hand, think of the multimillionaires that we know. How are they held in such great esteem? So now imagine somebody who has both, who's the biggest millionaire, is the biggest businessman, with great success and a lot of wealth, and he's also the greatest Talmid Chochem, he's also the greatest spiritual leader of his time. That was Boaz. Ruth is on the other extreme. She's a Moabite woman with no money at all. No family, no money. She comes from Moab. There's nobody who knows her. She doesn't know anybody. She has only one acquaintance, and that's her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law is destitute, and so is she. So she's no big Talmid Chochem. She's a non-Jewish girl, comes from Moab, into the Jewish community, with no contacts and connections whatever, and no money whatever. They are absolutely down and out. And she goes into the fields of Boaz, the wealthiest man and the greatest Talmid Chochem. Now you can imagine Boaz didn't exactly go around harvesting his own fields. He used to employ hordes of people to do that. So the chance of her even meeting Boaz was very slim. And he notices her. And he says, in fact, Vayomer Boaz lena'aroi, Boaz says to one of the young men that he's employed, one of his managers, Hanitzav alakotzim, who's busy managing the harvesters, lemi hana'aro hazois, who does this young girl belong to? Where does she come from? Vayan hana'ar hanitzav alakotzim vayomer, and this young manager answers and says, Na'aro mu'yavir, she's a Moabite woman. Hashovoim Naomi mistei Moab, she came back with that woman Naomi from Moab, she's a Moabite, nothing very important. And she said, he's now reporting, Al Ketor Nova Osafti Ba'amorim, I will collect among the sheaves, because the law is, as you know, that the sheaves that fall while they're busy harvesting, if something falls, the stuff that falls out while they're busy harvesting, the poor people are entitled to collect. Anything they forget in the field, the poor people are entitled to collect. The corners of the field where it's difficult to harvest, the poor people are entitled to collect. So she says, I'll go and collect. Batovi Vata Moed Me Oza Boike Vad Oto. And she's come and she stood here from the morning till now. She's now about to go home. And Boaz approaches Ruth. Boaz himself. Now imagine the interaction. Boaz himself now walks up to Ruth and addresses her. Imagine what that meant to her. Just the fact that he addressed her. And he says, Haloi shomat biti. You must listen to me, my daughter. Calls him biti. My daughter calls her biti. Al telchi lilkoit besodei acher. I don't want you going to collect in anybody else's field. Make yourself comfortable here. This is where you belong. Begam lo tavuri mizeh. Don't go away from here. You stay here with the young girls in my field. You keep your eye on whatever field they're busy harvesting, and you go after them and collect whatever you want. I've instructed the young men not to interfere with you. You can go to the well and drink from whatever they've drawn. Make yourself comfortable. She says thank you, and we'll see a little bit later how she does that. And then Boaz says, I've heard how kind you were to your mother-in-law, what chesed you showed to her after your husband died, how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came back with your mother-in-law, accompanied her all the way back here. May Hashem take care of you, and once again you should be comfortable here. Then when they sit down to eat, imagine the scene. Boaz comes out into the field to see how things are going. He sits down to have the meal together with his managers and his workers, and he invites Ruth to come and sit up there as well, and he gives her a little bit to eat. What is the value of that? What do we see here when we say the brochas and the fingers of Boaz? What are we talking about? What the Medrash is saying, it's not the food, it's the whole ambiance of that interaction. For that young girl to have been taken notice of, for her to have been treated with that kind of dignity and honor, for her to be sitting next to Boaz, for him to stretch out and put into her hand the koli, those little bits of grain, it's the gesture that was important. That's not all he gave her to eat. She was welcome. He's already told her she can eat whatever she wants. That's all she needed to eat. That filled her. That satisfied her totally. We think that what satisfies us is the bulk of the quantity of the food that we eat. It isn't so. That's a small part of it. That's a very small part of it. There is so much energy that is not contained in the food, that comes with the food, that is packaged with the food. And if it's packaged right, we don't need to get it all out of the food. Very, very different. There's no question that if one walks into a junk food outlet in New York and you're given one of these huge plates of food, it looks a little bit like when you give a dog something to eat, you've got to fill the bowl up. And it'll be packed, and he sits and he eats and he eats and he eats his way through it. And at the end of it, he feels satisfied when he gets to the bottom. That you can't give him little bits in the. You've got to fill it up. You've got to give him a real piled bowl full, otherwise he's not satisfied. And when you go to these junk food things, that's how they pile up your bowl. Fill it up, and then everybody tucks in. And you watch them tucking in, and they work their way through the bowl of food, and they go out and they sort of feel satisfied. As opposed to going to a very fine restaurant with a beautiful ambience, beautifully laid tables, candle on each table, flowers on each table, beautifully dressed waiters who welcome you nicely and make you feel like a $1 million and see you to your table and hold the chair for you to sit down and bring you a menu and ask you what you would like. And you order it and you get fairly small portions. Where do you feel more satisfied? Out of what experience do you go out feeling even physically satisfied? Where does your body become more satisfied? There's absolutely no question, for those of you who've had the opportunity to try that, there's no question that the you don't have to laugh. I'm not suggesting that you have to be non-kosher in order to have the opportunity to try it. I'm just suggesting you have to travel to other cities sometimes. That's all. The experience is very different, and you find that from a very small amount of food, one's able to savor it, to eat it slowly, to enjoy it. You taste all sorts of things that you don't normally taste, and the degree of satisfaction is much greater than when you sit down to a big pile of food in a junk food shop. And that's what it means when the Midrash explores, was it perhaps the fingers of Boaz that did it? Or was it Ruth that just knew how to get the most out of little things? Who knew how to find so much meaning and so much content? Where was the art? Was the art in Boaz or was the art in Ruth? And clearly by the fact that the Midrash says you can learn both of them, the truth is it was in both of them. He created the ambiance for her to feel completely comfortable and elevated, and in that elevation she was able to get enormous energy from small amounts of food. But she also knew how to do it. She was active in the Vatosa. She knew how to eat a little bit, how to feel satisfied, and to be able to leave over because she's got plenty. So we see here in this very classical case of Chesed, the relationship between the quantity of matter and the quality of energy. A little bit of food with a lot of feeling, with a lot of emotion, with a lot of dignity, with a lot of honor, and the impact that that has on her. That's Chesed. Chesed is not giving a hungry person a huge plate of food. That's tzedakah. That's feeding animals or feeding people. That's tzedakah. That's charity. Chesed is to make a person feel wonderful. That the food that you give him, it's not important how much it is. What's important is how it's presented, how you put it to him, the value you show that he holds in your eyes by the way you serve him, by what you give to him. If you look at one of the other great cases of Chesed with Avraham and the three angels. He didn't know they were angels. He thought they were Arabs. But look what he did. Look at the meal he gave them. And there was quantity, but the quantity there came with quality as well. There was a milk meal to start with. It was followed by a meat meal. He served them himself. He served them. And Chazal tell us it was because of the fact that he served them that Hashem gave us food in the desert. It wasn't the fact that he gave them food. That's simple. The fact that he was the waiter is what the Ribbono Shel Olam reacted to, what God reacted to in the desert. And God became the waiter to us when we needed it. He presented the food to us miraculously. Why? Because Avraham served it himself. He made those three Arabs, as he thought they were, feel important, feel valuable. That was the Chesed. The Chesed is not the material that you give the other person. The Chesed is the packaging, the energy that you package that Chesed, that material in, so that through the material they're able to get a great deal more. You might ask then, why give material at all? Why not just give dignity? When the poor person comes knocking at your door, why not treat him with enormous dignity and send him home with nothing? That's not any good either. And the reason that that's not any good is because at the end of the day, that didn't cost you anything. Because spiritual energy is limitless. It's infinite. And you can give it without losing anything. Not only can you give it without losing anything, but as we discussed last week, that by giving it, you actually gain. By generating more, you actually have more. So to give somebody spiritual things doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't hurt at all. On the contrary, one gets a great deal of pleasure from it. To give something material to somebody costs you, because that is limited. So there has to be a combination of both. I've got to be willing to put my hand in my pocket and take something material out of my pocket, which means I no longer have it. There's a degree of sacrifice on my part. But that's not enough to satisfy him. That's not going to satisfy him. How am I going to satisfy him? By everything else that comes together with that I've given him. By that way I can magnify the gift a million times. I can give him a few grains of corn, and if I package it with this kind of dignity, of course you have to be a Boaz to be able to do that. But if one can package it with that kind of dignity, those grains of corn are worth fortunes. And we discussed last week how it's worth fortunes even in money. It's worth fortunes not just in feeling. Because the elevation of self-esteem is such that that impacts the way the person goes about the rest of their day. That impacts the way not only they feel about themselves, but the way they present themselves, the way they sell themselves. If they have to go from there to a job interview, the chances are that because of the way you treated them, they're going to make a different kind of impression than they would have had you given them a bowl full of epo. But it's completely different. So that way you would have given them the food, but you wouldn't have given them that which went with it. This way you've uplifted them. And in fact, that theme comes in our Sedra today over and over again, because the Sedra really deals with the role of Chesed in an area where there are severe limitations. It starts with Shemitah. Work for 6 years, you work the field for 6 years, you don't work at the seventh year. It deals with Yovel, with fields going back to their original owners. It deals with slavery, that people sometimes have to do it. It deals with poverty, that people sometimes become poor and one needs to assist them. All the consequences of limited resources. And one of the things it says there, what happens if you're going to say before the Shemitah year, what are we going to eat next year? Where's the food going to come from? And the Torah says, "V'ochaltem lasoivo," you will eat with satisfaction. What does that mean? Rashi brings that af besoich hame'ayim tehei boi brocha. Doesn't matter how much food you've got, you'll be able to get a lot of satisfaction from small amounts of food. You won't need as much. You'll find that you don't need as much. So one of the interesting things about dieting is that usually when people diet, they do that at the same time because they're suffering from low self-esteem. And when you're suffering from low self-esteem, you need a whole lot of food. When you're feeling down and you're feeling miserable, you need compensation. So the process of dieting and the state of mind that one's in when one diets actually undermine each other, which is why dieting is invariably unsuccessful. It's very, very difficult to diet successfully. If instead one would bring the person to a point where he doesn't need so much food, doesn't have that requirement, he's getting energy, he's getting input from all sorts of other places. Food is just one of his sources of energy. And automatically he doesn't need to consume that much. The whole process, the whole approach has to change. The feeling has to approach where the energy is coming from. If one is totally dependent on food energy, and usually the reason a person goes on diet is because of that very thing, I'm totally dependent on energy from food, it doesn't help cutting it off. You can't. One compensates in other ways. In the time of the Shemitah, af b'toicha me'ayim tehei boi brocho, the Gemara says, oichel kimo misborech b'meyo, the person will eat a little bit and it will become much inside him. He'll be able to integrate it and draw energy out of small quantities that he wouldn't otherwise be able to do because of the relationship that he has with that food. Let's take that a little bit further and say that that's all very well, and giving is very important. Rav Dessler speaks about two forces, the koach hanasino and the koach hanatilo. There's a force of giving. People want to give, they need to give, it's part of what people do. But there's also koach hanatilo, there's also ambition. People have the desire to promote themselves, to develop themselves, to grow, to become stronger. And those two forces seem to contradict one each other. The koach hanasino and the koach hanatilo, the dynamic of giving and the dynamic of taking seem to be in conflict, and we're going to resolve that conflict. Because in the giving itself, there's an enormous amount of taking. And let's look at it from two points of view. Firstly, when Moshe went up the mountain, you remember, he was busy getting the Torah, experiencing the most unbelievable spiritual and existential experiences that no other human being has been able to fathom, never mind to experience. And while he was doing that, the children of Israel down below were dancing around the golden calf. Says God to Moshe, Lech Reid, go down, go back. Raid means, physically, literally it means go down the mountain, go back to them. But Chazal read into that Lech Raid as Lech Raid Migdulosko. Take a step down. You're not so great anymore. Lech Raid, you're going to decrease. You're not going to be the great Moshe anymore. And the Gemara says in Brochus and Daflamet Beis, Klum Nosati Lecho Gdulo Elo Bishvil Yisrael. Why did I make you great? Because you needed it in order to lead the people. Ve'achshav Yisrael Chotu, the people have gone their own way now. They've abandoned me. So what do you need the greatness for? What's the Gemara saying? That greatness is given to people in accordance with the need. And it's not necessarily their own need. It's the need of the people around them. That inspires that the Ribbono Shel Olam gives people stature and greatness and energy to cope with what they need to do. And the more responsibility a person takes on, the more he's blessed with, the more energy he's blessed with. Very often you look at people who've got big responsibilities, you look at people in the medical profession, you look at leadership and you say, how do they cope? How do they manage? It doesn't seem to be human. The answer is, it isn't human. They manage because they're blessed with enormous energy. And God gives that energy to people who've taken responsibilities on. As you take a responsibility on, so Hashem gives you the energy to cope with it. You know how it is when you're growing a family and you've got one child, you can't imagine possibly coping with two. And then you get two children and somehow you manage, but you can't imagine coping with three. And so it goes, and so with each added responsibility as one goes through life, you can't imagine actually how you're going to cope with it, but you do. And sometimes very well, and sometimes there's a lot of growth in the process of coping with it. And so as we said last week, that energy is unlike any other process of transference. You transfer an object, something material, transfer it, I lose it, you gain it. With energy, you actually can't, not only can't you transfer it, you can't even store it. You can't store energy. The only way you can generate energy is if there's somebody consuming it. And so if you want to increase your generation, you have to increase your consumption. You've got to have customers. You've got to have people who are taking it from you. And Moshe's greatness was dependent on the fact that he had 2 million customers. That's where his greatness came from. He was generating energy to 2 million people who needed him. That aroused an energy within him that was his gedulah, that was his greatness. The moment the people turned away, Hashem warns him and says, "Reid migdulosko, your time's up." All this energy that you've got, all this greatness, all this focus is going to disappear because there's nobody taking it off you. And so we need to understand that the Koach HaNesilah and the Koach HaNetilah are not entirely unrelated. That the dynamic of giving and the dynamic of taking are not unrelated. When you're giving, you're not losing. Not only aren't you losing, but when you're giving, when you're taking on responsibility, you're gaining enormous energy in order to cope with that responsibility. But that's from the point of view of God giving. That's a mystical approach. God gives a person an energy to cope with responsibility. But there's a psychological approach to it as well. And that's the next medrash that says the following. Tani Rabbi Yeshua taught, Yose mimash bal habayis oise im heoni, heoni oise im bal habayis. More than the rich man does for the poor man does for the rich man. You think that when a person's poor and a wealthy man gives him charity, that he's the giver and the poor man is the receiver. It's not so. The poor man's doing the rich man a bigger favor. Shekein Rus Omeris Lenormi, and we see that in the case of Ruth. Back to the source of the mitzvahs of Chesed. Ruth says to Naomi, now Ruth is out in the field and she's having this interaction with Boaz. And then she comes home. Vatomelo Chamoisa, so her mother-in-law says to her, Efoli katat hayoim, v'ono asis. Where were you today? You seem to have done quite well. She came back with a basket full of food for herself and for her mother-in-law. Yehi makirech baruch, whoever it was, may he be blessed. Where were you? Batageit lechamoiso es asher ososo imo. And she told her mother-in-law what she had done for him. And she said, Shemo ish asher asisi imo, the man I worked with today was Boaz. What work? What did you do with him? You just took. You didn't give anything. You didn't work. You didn't contribute. Say Chazal, she's very accurate. She understands that she gave him more than he gave her. What does that mean? The way it's usually taken to mean is very simply, you give the person the opportunity to give, you give the person the opportunity for a mitzvah. If there weren't any poor people, Rabbi Akiva's asked the question by a non-Jew in Bava Basra, if God likes people so much and he cares about the world, why did he create poor people? And he answers, because if there weren't any poor people, what merit would the rich people have? They grow out of giving. In order to give, you've got to have a poor person to take. That Gemara has all sorts of difficulties on its own. But there is, and that's how people generally explain this medrash, that the poor person facilitates the act of giving for the rich person. And it's more important, what you gain from the giving is much more than what the poor person gained from the receiving. But we need to look at it in a little bit more depth. Let's look at the interaction between Boaz and Ruth. It's so beautiful. We studied this in the ladies' shul a little while ago in a lot of detail. He notices something very special about her. There were lots of girls collecting there. Why does he ask about her? So he asks this young manager, who is she? And the young manager tries to say, nobody to really worry about. She's a Moabite woman. But then he tells Boaz what she said, that she stood at the back, that she stood on the side, that she hasn't encroached, that she didn't stand in front of the young men and didn't engage in conversation with them, she just went around her business quietly. Boaz notices a special quality in her, and so he questions, who is she? He hears that her name is Ruth and that she came with Naomi. Now he's already heard the gossip in the town that Naomi's come back from Moab and that this young daughter-in-law abandoned her family and her home to take care of her mother-in-law. So he knows already that this is an exceptional person. And when we studied this with in the ladies' shul, we actually looked at the different perspectives. The young manager, who's in charge, looks at her as a Moabite woman. That's her label. That's who she is. He stereotypes her. She's a Moabite woman. Therefore, there's nothing to worry about. Boaz looks right into her and says, this is a woman who made enormous sacrifice to take care of her mother-in-law. This is a woman who's acting with such modesty and such beauty in the way she's interacting on the field and the way she functions. She's different from all the others. So he starts taking an interest in her. And of course, you know the end of the story. Of course, they get married and live happily ever after. And he says to her, I don't want you going anywhere else. I want you to stay in my field. This is before there's any transfer of anything material yet. He hasn't given her any food. He hasn't invited her to dinner yet. The first thing he says is, I want you to stay in my field. What's he saying to her? You are so valuable to me. You're doing me a favor by staying here. You're elevating the whole standard of the people's interaction. You're elevating the whole society in which we're operating. It's important to me that you stay in the field. And I've told my men not to interfere with you, and you can help yourself and so on. How does she respond? She doesn't say, just say thank you, that's very kind of you. It's alright. But tipul al poneho, but tishtachu out. So she falls on her face and she bows down to this great man. But Tomerov, and she says to him, Madu amotsosichen beinecho lahakireni vani nochri. I don't understand. Who am I? What have I done to deserve this? I'm from a strange land. I'm not even one of yours. How are you reacting to me in this way? What have I done? What does that do in Boaz? That arouses. Furthermore, he says, no, I've heard a great deal about you, what you did, how you related to your mother-in-law. May you be paid by Hashem. And she says, Emtzochen be'inecho adoni ki nichamtoni. Thank you, my master. You've comforted me. You've made me feel good. V'chidibarto elev shikhosecho. You've spoken into my heart. You haven't told me superficial things. You've really penetrated my heart. You've made me feel so good. What's she doing to him now? Making him feel so good. You've gotten through to me in a way that nobody else has. It's unbelievable. And what have I done to deserve this? So look at the energy now that's going between them. I'm not even like one of your employees. You're treating me in such a special way. And Boaz responds by inviting her to eat, to sit down at the meal, and he gives her that particular food. What would have happened had Boaz said to her, yes, I've seen you here, make yourself at home? And she would have said, thank you, I will. And she would have gone around collecting as much food as she wanted and waved goodbye and gone off to her mother-in-law and turned up the next day for more. What would have happened? Nothing would have happened. It would have been the end of the story. What's happening in here is he's giving her something non-material. She's saying, but in what way can I reciprocate? How can I give back? Who am I? Why are you doing this to me? And he's saying, no, because you're a very special person. And she's saying, no, you're the one who's special. You're the person who knows how to speak to people. You've penetrated my heart. You're the one who's special, not me. I'm not even one of your employees. So she's in the relationship is elevating him, and he's elevating her. Neither are cheapening themselves. Each one is going through a process of elevating the other. When it's a thing like that, on that Rabbi Yeshua can say, how did Boaz feel that evening when he went home? Is what he felt, was it worth more or less than the cost of the little bit of food he gave to Rus? Much more. He felt wonderful. She'd appreciated it. She'd responded so beautifully. There had been such humility and such beauty in the way she responded. She made him feel important. He made her feel important. He saw the beam on her face, the radiance on her face as he elevated her. How did he feel? So who did more for who? And she goes home, and in the way she reports the story to her mother-in-law, she almost subconsciously implies this lesson. I know I was the poor person, but don't think I left him impoverished. Don't think I took from him without giving to him. And she might even have known that had that been the case, Naomi would not have accepted it. That had she felt that Ruth had merely taken from Boaz, Naomi probably would have said, take it back. We don't need it. So Ruth makes her feel comfortable and says, yes, I was in Boaz's field, but I did something for him too. I worked for him too. I made him feel good. I didn't just take. And then the Medrash can say the poor person can do much more for the rich person than the rich person does for the poor person. Because the rich person gives material things to the poor person. The poor person, by the way he accepts it, gives the rich person an enormous feeling of value and of worth. That being the case, what we're saying is that there's energy that comes from the recipient. It's not just in the case of chesed, it's not just that you energize the recipient. Yes, you energize the recipient. But there's a tremendous amount of energy that comes from the way things are received. Not always. We said last week, there are the drainers and there are the energizers. But last week we talked about drainers and energizers just in normal interaction. Now we're talking about draining and energizing in the process of receiving. Because we all receive. And that's the most dangerous time of all, because that's the moment that determines whether an interaction is going to be draining or energizing. When a person greets you with a smiling face and a full heart and with a lot of enthusiasm and energy, and you just answer, good morning. That's the point at which you've drained the person. You've taken without giving anything back. That's the moment of drainage. The moment is at the point of receiving, not at the point of giving. The person gives without much energy, and you take without much energy, so fine. Nothing's been lost. He didn't invest much, and you... way that leaves the giver feeling energized. That leaves the giver feeling that he's received more than he's given. That's what chesed really means. One has to know how to receive it as well. We've sometimes talked about the phenomenon of the concert artist, a violinist, pianist. Would he be able to produce the same quality of music if he didn't have an audience? And we've often said, no, he wouldn't. No matter how technically good he is, no matter how he loves his music, no matter how many hours he practices, if he didn't have the opportunity to play before an audience and to give and to be energized by that audience, there wouldn't be extracted from him that quality of performance. Is that arrogance? Is that showing off? That when he's in front of an audience, he plays better than when he's not in front of an audience? No. It's not a choice that he makes, that he says, well, people are watching me, so I better play better. When he's practicing, he tries to play his best as well. But it doesn't come out with that same brilliance. You can listen to recordings of music, and you can tell which are done in studios and which are done live, even without having to listen to the clapping. You can hear by the quality of the playing. There's a dimension in a live performance that is absent in a studio performance. There's much greater clarity in a studio performance. There's much more technical precision in a studio performance. The quality of sound is much better, but there's a dynamic of energy that is missing in a studio performance that isn't there in a live performance. And in a recording, if you're listening to a record or a CD, it's a minute difference. You've got to listen very carefully to hear the difference. But when you're present, it's totally different. Listening to a live concert, even of a lower quality, is far more energizing than listening to a recording of the greatest quality, because there's interaction. There's some kind of energy that is transferred from the performer to the audience and from the audience to the performer. There are all sorts of different ways that affects people. It certainly is an element of teaching, and one has it all the time. For a shiur like this, there's no question, if I would prepare the shiur and not have the opportunity to give it to people who value it sufficiently to come on a Saturday night and sit for an hour, it wouldn't be the same. The quality of the thinking wouldn't be the same. The quality of the delivery wouldn't be the same. The whole thing wouldn't be the same. The people who are present have an enormous impact on the way one delivers, on the way one thinks, on what comes out of a person. It's a two-way interaction. It's not a one-way interaction. Of course, there can be a draining receiving, and there can be a giving receiving in an audience, just as there can be in a one-to-one interaction. You can have a performer who performs in front of an audience and he walks out feeling thoroughly drained and disappointed. One can be teaching, one can be giving a shiur, and one can walk out very drained and very disappointed, and one can walk out very elated and very enthused. It depends on the interaction. And what is flowing? Is there anything really flowing? Nothing. Everybody's sitting with a distance between them. So what is the nature of that flow? That's an energy flow. That's the ability to receive in such a way that leaves the giver with more energy than he had before he started the process of giving. Let's go back to our Medrash. So the Gemara, the Medrash says, had Reuven known that it would be reported in the Torah that he saved his brother Yosef, that's not how he would have done it. He would have taken Yosef back to his father. Was that an intellectual choice, thinking to himself, well, no one's watching, so I'll just put him in the pit. But had people been watching, I would take him to his father. That's not what it is. He didn't have the energy it required to resist his brother's will and to take the group of his brothers and to take Yosef back to his father against their will. He didn't have the energy that would have required. Had he had an international audience, he would have had the energy that it required. The knowledge of the people who were going to learn from this, the knowledge of the people who were going to read this and study this, the knowledge of the people's of how people would respond to the story, would have energized him and enabled him to be able to do it. The same with Boaz. He knew that she would be very satisfied with the food he gave her. He knew he was giving her enough to satisfy her. He knew he was providing an environment in which she felt very comfortable and elated. That wasn't the issue. So why didn't he give her more than that? He didn't have the energy to give her more than that. Had he known that this would have become part of the Book of Ruth and we would have read it every Shavuos and people would be studying it, he would have had much more energy. That's the effect, the impact that the energy of the audience can have on the performer. And that's to know the effect of the energy of the audience on the performer. And one finds that it comes in all sorts of different ways. There are two young ladies who were at the shiur last week, and they went home together, and almost simultaneously the one said to her, "That was an incredible shiur," another one said to her, "I didn't understand a word of it." They're both extremely intelligent people. So they spent a while going over it, and the one told me a couple of days later, she said, "I didn't sleep for 3 nights because of that shiur." That gives energy. She had to suffer not sleeping 3 nights, but that gives such energy. That is the energy that enables a person to achieve things, to think, to draw from themselves that which otherwise wouldn't be possible to do. The question is, when do we have an audience? Does that mean that we can only perform when there's an audience? Yes. That says the Medrash, don't think the audience has to be in front of you at that time. Just as Reuven's audience was there thousands of years later, we are now audiences of Reuven. We're reliving the whole scene, we're watching it thousands of years later. Boaz's audience, thousands of years later. The audience isn't necessarily in front of you at the time you're doing it. Sometimes it's filmed and the audience watches it later on. That doesn't matter, as long as you know there's going to be an audience. Imagine some of the great film stars, if we were filming them and we told them, "Look, we're filming this film, it's a magnificent film, but nobody's going to watch it. We'll pay you the same, but nobody is ever going to see this film. We're going to destroy it the moment we've finished filming it." What kind of performance would we get out of them? And if we tell them, "This film you're doing, there are millions of people are going to be watching this. This is going to shape the thinking of the whole world." What kind of acting do we get out of them? The audience doesn't have to be there present at the time of acting, but one needs to know that it's important, that it has impact, that there is a flow of energy. And so the Medrash says one needs to know that even what we do, Hashem writes down, Eliyahu writes down, the Mashiach, we are busy developing history, and every action that we perform has a value to it, and it plays a part, and there is an audience. It's important. I want to take it one step further. And that is that it's possible to engage in this giving and taking even on one's own. The audience doesn't have to be an external audience. There's such a thing as an internal audience as well. Another medrash in the same sedra, it's just so rich with these medrashim. Based on the posuk in Mishlei of Gomel Nafshoi Ish Chesed, of a man who does kindness to himself. What does that mean? Says the Medrash, "Zeh Hillel Hazokin, Shebeshor Shoya Nifta Mitalmidov." When Hillel used to finish his shiur and he used to walk out, Hayom Mahalech Vehelech Imo, the imam, he used to walk with them. Omru Lo Talmidov, and his Talmidim used to ask him, "Rebbe Lehechon Atahelech, where are you going?" What made them ask the question? I would imagine that he was walking with a great deal of purpose. Normally when you walk away from something, you walk slowly, you walk off. But he obviously was walking towards something, and they were fascinated, "Where are you going now?" Omru Lehem Lasus Mitzvah. He said, "I'm going to do a mitzvah." Amr levechi, "Ma mitzvah?" Interesting. What mitzvah are you about to do that you're so energetic about? Amr lehen, "Lirchoitz beveis hamerchatz." I'm going to have a shower. That's the mitzvah. That's why I'm so excited. So just imagine this. Hillel HaZaken is walking with such enthusiasm and such excitement that the Talmidim notice it sufficiently to say, "Where are you going? What's up?" He says, "I'm going to do a mitzvah." "What mitzvah could it be that you're doing with such energy?" "So I'm going to have a shower." I said, "That's an interesting mitzvah. Is that a mitzvah? Where does it say, 'Thou shalt shower'?" Amar lahem, he said to them, sometimes they put up statues of the king in the public places. And you sometimes drive past them and you see people washing them. And the king pays those people, the government pays them to wash those statues. On the contrary, sometimes these cleaners they grow up in the civil service, and you know what it is in the civil service, you can start as a statue cleaner, you can land up a prime minister. I'm created in the image of God, I'm such a statue. So when I'm washing myself, I'm washing God's image. That's some mitzvah. I would imagine if the king regards it as important to wash his statues, God regards it as quite important that I should always be looking magnificent. I'm representing God. This is God's image. How do people know what God looks like? Only by looking at me. And by at you, at everybody. That's how you see godliness. It's the only manifestation of godliness we have, is the human being. So surely I have a responsibility to present that godliness in the finest way possible. I need to be well groomed, I need to be well presented, I need to look good. I hope that, that a lot of the people one sees around aren't images of God, because then one's, one's image of God gets a little tarnished. Another story. The same Hillel HaZakian, Shebeshosho Yoniv Tamid Tamidov, when he used to leave his Tamid in Ayom HaHalef or Helech Imam, they went with him. Omrul Tamidim, same story. Rebbe Lehechen HaTahirich, another time the Tamidim said, so this must have been his style, that he walked with a lot of purposefulness in his walk. And they said, where are you going? So he said, Ligmul Chesedim Adein Achsanya Begur Beisa, I'm going to do kindness to my guest at home. Omrul Kol Yoim Islach Achsanya. They said to him, you know, we asked you yesterday and you said that. We asked you the day before and you said that. We've been asking you for weeks and you always give us the same answer. Do you always have a guest staying at home and we never see him? Is my soul not a guest in my body? Today it's here, tomorrow it might be gone. It's temporary. So my soul is also a guest. And I'm going to take care of my soul. I'm going to have something to eat, I'm going to rest, I'm going to learn a little bit, I'm taking care of my guest. It's a little bit like that story that I think I've told before of the lady and the Meshulach and his wife who came out to South Africa, and they were visiting people and trying to raise some money. She came out for the first time with him, and she used to go around with him to the various kavirim, to the wealthy people. And she was sitting at one such occasion, and the Balabos, the wealthy man, was busy asking the Meshulach about his institution, how many people and what do they do and who supports it and so on. And then he turned to her and he said to her, what do you do? So she said, I run a home for underprivileged children. And he said, that's wonderful. And how many children do you have? She said, there are 12 children in the home at the moment. He said, that's fantastic. And who takes care of them? She said, I do. And you do everything? You employ people? She said, no, can't afford to employ people, so I do it all. He said, you mean to say you cook for them, you dress them, you take care of their schooling? She says, the lot. And who pays for their schooling? She said, I do. I pay for it. He said, but this is incredible. Why is your husband busy telling me about his institution? What you're doing is much more important. I would like to contribute to it. Who runs it? Where do you get money from? She said, well, they're my children. I support them. He said, oh, that's your children. Well, that's her. She said, I don't understand. Why have you lost interest now that I told you that they're my children? If I was looking after 12 strangers, I would have been a hero. Now that I'm looking after my 12 children, if I don't look after them, they're underprivileged, nobody else will. All of a sudden, I'm not worthy. Hillel looks at himself that way and says, why do we only have to do kindness to visitors? What about my own soul? It's also a visitor. Why doesn't it deserve some attention also? And when I'm doing it, and here's the beauty of it, the ability to view yourself as another person, to be able to interact with yourself. Because if you can interact with yourself, you can do chesed to yourself. And you can see it not as taking, but as giving. And that's the importance of what Hillel is saying. When I take a shower, I'm not taking a shower, I'm giving a shower. When I take a meal, I'm not taking a meal, I'm giving a meal. I'm giving it to myself. I'm also valuable. I'm also important. I'm also a guest here. I also need to be taken care of. And yes, I use my physical ability to nourish my spirit. And that's chesed too. And if that's chesed, that means there can be an energy developed within oneself as well. It's possible to interact with oneself. It's possible to do kindness to oneself and to reciprocate and to respond. And when the soul feels satisfied, when you do kindness to your soul responds and makes your body feel good as well. When you invest something in your mind reciprocates and invests something in your body. When you invest something in your soul reciprocates and invests something in your body. You can build internal energy quite apart from the enormity of energy that one can build by interrelating with people outside of one. By engaging with oneself as if one were two people. A give and take relationship with oneself as somebody worthy, as somebody valuable. It's possible to develop that energy within oneself too. And so coming back to last week, yes, there are limited resources, and yes, there is an unlimited source of energy to which we are able to tap in, represented by the right hand side of the Ten Commandments and the left hand side of the Ten Commandments. And yes, when we give, when we attend to people's limited resources, we need to give more than more limited resources. We need to use our ability to tap into the infinite to help the person who has limitations. But we don't have to only do it to strangers. we can do it to ourselves as well. We also have limitations, but we also have access to infinity, and we can tap that infinity and we can energize our souls with it as well. And just as when we do it to strangers, the strangers reciprocate, and the energy they reciprocate with, the smile on their face, the gratitude, the note they write us, the thank you that they say, is so terribly important to us, so very, very valuable to us, and makes us feel so good, and that energizes us to go along and to go further. So when we do kindness to ourselves, when we invest in ourselves, that also creates an energy within ourselves that enables us to go further. If we're going to wrap ourselves in the spiritual, or wrap ourselves in the material, if we're going to become obsessed by the limited resources, or we're going to become indulged in the limitless resources, and not create an interface between the two, we're going to become impoverished very quickly. It's only by that unique ability that the Torah teaches to engage the one with the other, to compensate for the limitation of material resources with the limitlessness of spiritual resources, to interact with people in that way and to interact with oneself in that way, that energy is able to be generated that can propel us to ever greater heights.